Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Hi guys, welcome back to another episode of Textory. Oh, what was that voice crack? Anyway, if you're somehow new here, my name is Karolina Żebrowska, and in this podcast, we find really interesting historical texts, and we dissect them, and we dive into them, and we try to relate to them, because one of my favorite things is when I'm reading something from like 1630s or 1920s, and I'm just like, why does this sound like it was written yesterday? Why is it so modern? So I hope you have your tea at the ready, because we shall be spilling it today. Let me just put it mildly. Just a reminder that I currently have a Patreon for this podcast. So if you want to support what I'm doing, if you want me to keep releasing new episodes, please do support. The lowest tier is $5. So I think it's pretty accessible to everyone. And you're going to get some little perks in return. So head to patreon.com/textory to check that out. And let's get into it. Today, we are focusing on one remarkable lady, dare I say, that I both admire. And at the same time, the more I read into it, the more I'm like, what she's done, even by modern moral standards, it's like not a way to treat people. But considering the era she's lived in, considering that she was a woman, she's still a queen. And it is absolutely incredible how independent and how strong she was, while at the same time, her life was completely dependent on men. So that woman is Harriet Wilson, courtesan from the Regency era. Also, shout out to my friend Shannon for recommending me this one, because this text is so good. It reads so well. Like, she really had a light pen, shall we say. So we are reading her memoirs today. And you probably know that I usually only present fragments of longer texts. Like, I would just pick a few interesting pieces. But with this one, it was literally so difficult because I wasn't even like 1/4 in, and I already had way too much spicy fragments to share with you. Like, I literally had to stop myself because the episode would be like 5 hours long. But I highly recommend a read if you're interested, because it definitely showed me an absolutely different side of the Regency era than what we're used to. And I wish the producers of Bridgerton have read this, because then maybe they would understand that women at the time were capable and clever and influential, and not just like reduced to timid flowers that are looking for a match. Oh, I'm looking for a match. Oh, I need to make a match. Stop saying that. Why are they always saying that? Anyway, Harriet Wilson was born in 1786 to a coal merchant who had a shop in Mayfair, London. To put it mildly, there were a lot of kids in that house. Some of them were coming and going and not really surviving infancy, but even then, there were still a lot of kids left. I think it was like 12 kids or something. And the parents were not happily married either, as we will soon hear from Harriet herself. So the way it began was one of Harriet's sisters, Amy, an older sister, one day she just left house to live with a man. And this was sort of the catalyst to what happened with the family after, because eventually Amy went on to become a courtesan, and so did Fanny, another one of Harriet's sisters, and then Harriet herself, and then their another sister, Sophia. So overall, four daughters from one family chose that path, which to me shows how troubled that family must must have been, because if that seemed like a good solution, I know it sounds glamorous to become a courtesan, but especially in the beginning of their careers, that basically meant that they had to leave the house, usually while very much underage, and they had to live with complete strangers much older than them, and they were not allowed to come back home. So it definitely wasn't all roses and sunshine. It wasn't like an easy thing to do. So as I said, Harriet followed her sister's example, and she left home at 15 to become a mistress to Lord Craven. Honestly, fuck that guy. Like, and she even describes their relationship as, like, I wouldn't say abusive, but he just didn't care about her at all, and she didn't care about him. She complains about him being obsessed with cocoa trees and that he had a stupid nightcap that he wore, so she did not have any fond memories of him. I think it's interesting how with her choice of lovers, because she didn't stop there, she just like kept switching people, you literally can see her climbing the social ladder. So some even say that she was the lover of King George IV. But there is really no mention of that anywhere. However, that's also something that, okay, you're going to see why there might be no mention of it, but basically he could pay. But okay, let me not spoil this for you. Time passes, she ages, she gets to being around 40. And eventually all the famous people that were her clients and that were like, yeah, I'm going to provide for you later in life, worry not, I'm going to support you financially, let me know whatever you need, they did not deliver. And she is getting pissed. So she writes her memoirs where she names absolutely everyone that she ever crossed paths with. And she reads them to filth. She does not describe them very favorably, to put it mildly. She is calling all these ugly old men out. And her publisher is like, wait, we can probably make more money by not publishing this. So if we wrote to all the people that are mentioned and we low-key blackmail them into paying us so this stays unpublished, we can make a bank. So what they supposedly did is they sent it to 200 of her former lovers. By the way, a body count of 200 in an era of no protection and like basically no medicine as we know it is absolutely insane. However, she was like, if you want to not be mentioned, if you want the mention to be edited out, you need to pay up. She famously wrote to Duke of Wellington, who was one of her clients that she definitely did not enjoy. She describes him as like ugly and boring. And he just replied, publish and be damned. And so she did. She went on, she published memoirs. And that's why I think if someone's not mentioned, it doesn't necessarily mean that they were not involved with her, but it cannot just mean that they paid. But the memoirs were published in 1825. And what I think is unusual is that it is quite early to publish memoirs at 40, especially since all the people are still there. But maybe it is because it was all so fresh and most of the subjects were still alive that the memoirs were in such high demand, they had to build a barrier in front of the shop because people were flocking in to get their hands on a copy, which I think in an era where half of them probably couldn't read is like quite significant. So we're going to read some of the things that she wrote. It's difficult to pick good fragments because she describes her relations. So I would have to describe like all of the relations and how they started and how they ended. I think we can still enjoy those with like minimum context. First of all, she had the best opening line in like memoir history. She knew what she was doing with the opening line. And the opening line is, I shall not say why and how I became, at the age of 15, the mistress of the Earl of Craven. Absolutely hooked from the very first sentence. She knew what she was doing. And I have to say, the way she describes things is just, it reads incredibly well. It reads like a novel. Okay, let's continue. Whether it was love or the severity of my father, the depravity of my own heart, or the winning arts of the noble lord, which induced me to leave my paternal roof and place myself under his protection, does not now much signify. Or if it does, I am not in the humor to gratify curiosity in this matter. So what I find interesting is that she's very mysterious about this one, but she goes into like heavy detail with all the other relations that she had. But the first one, she does not want to tell you how it happened. And I'm assuming maybe there was some abuse involved, because what girl goes off with a guy at the age of 15 if she has not been in like a really difficult situation? So her relation with Craven, as I said, was not fantastic. And she was looking for some other options. She keeps mentioning that, you know, she wasn't trying to be with someone while she was with Craven, but at the same time, she kind of did. I was not depraved enough to determine immediately on a new choice, and yet I often thought about it. How indeed could I do otherwise, when the Honorable Frederick Lamb was my constant visitor and talked to me of nothing else? However, in justice to myself, I must declare that the idea of the possibility of deceiving Lord Craven while I was under his roof never once entered into my head. Frederick was then very handsome and certainly tried with all his soul and with all his strength to convince me that constancy to Lord Craven was the greatest nonsense in the world. I firmly believe that Frederick Lamb sincerely loved me and deeply regretted that he had no fortune to invite me to share with him. So around that time, she's like, I need a new man. Lord Craven's not doing it for me, but also I don't want to be homeless. So she does something very bold, which was mostly like a joke, but I do believe she could have gone through with it. But she writes to Prince of Wales, who went on to become George IV, and she writes this letter. A reminder, she was 15 at the time. She writes this. I am told that I am very beautiful, so perhaps you would like to see me. Oh my God, she's so confident. And I wish that, since so many are disposed to love me, one, for in the humility of my heart I should be quite satisfied with one, would be at the pains to make me love him. In the meantime, this is all very dull work, sir, and worse even than being at home with my father. So if you pity me and believe you could make me in love with you, write to me and direct to the post office here. She definitely took her chances, and she actually got an answer from what she thinks was Colonel Thomas and not really Prince of Wales himself. But the letter said, Miss Wilson's letter has been received by the noble individual to whom it was addressed, very delicate, not to like leave any loose ends in case anything leaks. If Miss Wilson will come to town, she may have an interview by directing her letter as before. So she lived in Brighton at the time. They were in London. So she answered the note, again addressing it to the Prince of Wales. Sir, to travel 52 miles this bad weather, merely to see a man, with only the given number of legs, arms, fingers, etc., would, you must admit, be madness in a girl like myself, surrounded by humble admirers who are ever ready to travel any distance for the honor of kissing the tip of her little finger. But if you can prove to me that you are one bit better than any man who may be ready to attend my bidding, I'll even start for London directly. So if you can do anything better in the way of pleasing a lady than ordinary men, write directly. If not, adieu, Monsieur le Prince. This was not continued. This was just like banter. I mean, it is speculated that they did enter a relation later in life, but at that time, nothing came out of it. But basically, she was growing tired of Craven, and she was flirting with Frederick Lamb for funsies because she didn't actually like him, but someone told on her. So Frederick Lamb, who was a military man, had to leave for Hull in Yorkshire. And 2 days after he left, she says, Lord Craven returned to Brighton, where he was immediately informed by some spiteful enemy of mine that I had been during the whole of his absence openly intriguing with Frederick Lamb. So Craven wrote like a breakup letter, which was surprisingly wholesome. It was like, if you need anything, let me know. I wish you all the best, blah, blah, blah. But she's saying that she was in deep shit because she was out of family home. There was no way she could ever return because they were probably like disowning her. So she was on like the brink of being homeless. She says, "My present situation was rather melancholy and embarrassing. And yet, I felt my heart the lighter for my release from the cocoa trees, without its being my own act and deed. It is my fate, I thought, for I never wronged this man. I hate his fine carriage and his money and everything belonging to or connected with him. I shall hate cocoa as long as I live. This is what one gets by acting with principle." The next morning, while I was considering what was to become of me, I received a very affectionate letter from Frederick Lamb, dated Hull. He dared not, he said, be selfish enough to ask me to share his poverty, and yet he had a kind of presentiment that he should not lose me. My case was desperate, for I had taken a vow not to remain another night under Lord Craven's roof. So she was basically like, I don't really like this man. I'm not in love with this man, but I need a place to stay right now, ASAP. So I'm leaving. John, therefore, the black whom Craven had, I suppose, imported with his cocoa trees from the West Indies, was desired to secure me a place in the mail for Hull. This is always throwing me off how they're just describing black people as being like imported with cocoa trees, but this is a subject for like a whole separate episode, I fear. It is impossible to do justice to the joy and rapture which brightened Frederick's countenance when he flew to receive me and conducted me to his house, where I was shortly visited by his worthy general, Mackenzie, who assured me of his earnest desire to make my stay in Hull as comfortable as possible. We continued here for about 3 months and then came to London. Fred Lamb's passion increased daily, but I discovered on our arrival in London that he was a voluptuary, somewhat worldly and selfish. My comforts were not considered. I lived in extreme poverty while he contrived to enjoy all the luxuries of life and suffered me to pass my dreary evenings alone while he frequented balls, masquerades, etc. Secure of my constancy, he was satisfied, so was not I. I felt that I deserved better from him. Fair. Why would you make a girl follow you, first of all, to Hull of all places, then after Hull to London, and then you would leave and have fun and you would like leave her home alone with no money? I asked Frederick one day if the Marquis of Lorne was as handsome as he had been represented to me. This is so bold to like scout your future lovers through your current lover. This would probably not fly in the modern times. "The finest fellow on earth," said Frederick Lamb. "All the women adore him." Wow, this guy is completely oblivious. And then he went on to relate various anecdotes of his lordship, which strongly excited my curiosity. Soon after this, he quitted town for a few weeks, and I was left alone in London, without money, or at any rate, with very little. This idea disgusted me. And in a fit of anger, I wrote to the Marquis of Lorne merely to say that if he would walk up to Duke's Row, Somersetown, he would meet a most lovely girl. She is so bold, like just writing her potential lovers and being like, do you want to meet someone like really cute? This was his answer. If you are half as lovely as you think yourself, you must be well worth knowing. But how is that to be managed? Not in the street, but come to number 39 Portland Street and ask for me, L. But she was like, absolutely not. I'm not going to a men's place on the first date. We need to meet in public, which like, girl, I see you. We are still experiencing your legacy. So she says, my reply was this, no. Our first meeting must be on the high road, in order that I may have room to run away, in case I don't like you. Which again, completely fair. The Marquis rejoined, well then, fair lady, tomorrow at 4, near the turnpike, look for me on horseback, and then you know I can gallop away. So they're basically like flirting through letters. We met. The Duke, he has since succeeded to the title, did not gallop away. And for my part, I had never seen a countenance I thought half so beautifully expressive. His manner was most gracefully soft and polished. We walked together for about 2 hours. I never saw such a sunny, happy countenance as yours in my whole life, said Argyle to me. Oh, but I am happier than usual today, answered I very naturally. I love that not only she raised him up, but she also recognizes her own game. So she's like, I said it very naturally, by the way. I ate this. Before we parted, the Duke knew as much of me and my adventures as I knew myself. He was very anxious to be allowed to call on me. And how will your particular friend Frederick Lamb like that? Inquired I. She's so flirty. The Duke laughed. Well then, said His Grace, do me the honor someday to come and dine or sup with me at Argyle House. I shall not be able to run away if I go there, I answered laughingly in allusion to my last note. She has so much game. Shall you want to run away from me? Said Argyle, and there was something unusually beautiful and eloquent in his countenance, which brought a deep blush into my cheek. When we know each other better, added Argyle beseechingly. En attendant, will you walk again with me tomorrow? I assented, and we parted. So this is basically it. Like, that's how she raised him up. They just met. She was like, I kind of like you, and also you're cute. And he was like, yeah, same. Do you want to come to dinner sometime? And she's like, yeah, sure. The only problem is, like, she's practically engaged with this other fellow. And she is aware of that. I have to give her that. Every time she pulled something like this, where she was like already looking for a new lover while in the relationship, every time she would have like those feelings of guilt. I returned to my home in unusual spirits. They were a little damped, however, by the reflection that I had been doing wrong. I cannot, I reasoned with myself, I cannot, I fear, become what the world calls a steady, prudent, virtuous woman. This is so funny because when I first read it, I thought she means like, I cannot do this. Like, I can't do this to Frederick. But no, she's like, I cannot not do this. That time is past, even if I was ever fit for it. Still, I must distinguish myself from those in the like unfortunate situations by strict probity and love of truth. I will never become vile. I will always adhere to good faith, as long as anything like kindness and honorable principle is shown towards me. And when I am illused, I will leave my lover rather than deceive him. Which, it has to be said that she did tell Frederick Lamb about everything. She was like, so yeah, this happened, we met, and Frederick is like, wow, that dude thinks he can have you and you're so devoted to me, right? And she's like, right. So Frederick actually encourages her to be involved with Argyle because he thinks that it's going to be funny, but she knows there is actual risk involved. But before she told Frederick, she went to that appointment that she made with Argyle at the turnpike. And if you've ever been stood up on a date or if the guy was humongously late, you are going to relate to this one. The next morning, with my heart beating unusually high, I attended my appointment with Argyle. I hoped, nay, almost expected, to find him there before me. I paraded near the turnpike 5 minutes, then grew angry. In 5 more, I became wretched. In 5 more, downright indignant. And in 5 more, wretched again. And so I returned home. This, thought I, shall be a lesson to me hereafter never to meet a man. It is unnatural. The amount of times this went through my head as I was headed to a date was like, this should be a lesson to me. This is not natural. And yet I had felt it perfectly natural to return to the person whose society had made me so happy. No matter, reasoned I, we females must not suffer love or pleasure to glow in our eyes until we are quite sure of a return. We must be dignified. Lesson to all y'all listening ladies. We must not suffer love or pleasure to glow in our eyes until we are quite sure of a return. 1825, write that one down. What is funny to me is he wrote her a letter. I don't remember if he like explained the situation or gave an excuse. And then she was like, yeah, sure, no problem. We can meet at the same place tomorrow. And then she didn't come because she's a vengeful girl. And she was like, you know what? You're going to see what it's like. So then he got stressed out. And then he was like, no, okay, I need to see you. Like, what is going on? Blah, blah, blah. So she pulled an Uno reverse on him and it worked. So they did reconcile. They went on a couple of dates, I think we can call them, where they just like kissed. Nothing really happened. But then she just felt a lot of guilt. And she was like, we can't really do this. And she told Frederick Lamb about this, as I said. And he was like, okay, this is fun. Let's keep it going. But she was like, no, this is actually not working. So she wrote a letter to Argyle saying that she can't continue this and they must continue as friends. And then Argyle was like, okay, sure. I don't think you love me. And then she says this, I will do myself the justice to say that I have seldom in the whole course of my life been tempted by my passions or my fancies to what my heart and conscience told me was wrong. I am afraid my conscience has been a very easy one, but certainly I have followed its dictates. There was a want of heart and delicacy, I always thought, in leaving any man without full and very sufficient reasons for it. This is the part where she mentions her parents. At the same time, my dear mother's marriage had proved to me so forcibly the miseries of two people of contrary opinions and character, torturing each other to the end of their natural lives, that before I was 10 years old, I decided in my own mind to live free as heir from any restraint but that of my own conscience. This all sounds very noble and stuff, but then... Then she was basically poor because Frederick Lamb was not providing for her. And at some point, her servant said, we don't have any food. And she was like, you know what? I'm going to hook up with Argyle because I need dinner. And that's what she did. She wrote to him. She was like, I am coming over today. And that's how their whole romance began. So she hooked up with him. The very next day, she goes to Fred to tell him about it. So I have to give her that. But a cheater is still a cheater. So, like, I'm reading this going like, yeah, but also that's not really... But at the same time, I know that she couldn't just stay homeless. And if she told Fred that she didn't love him anymore and she was made to leave, and then Argyle didn't take her in, she would be living in the streets. So, like, I do understand how desperate the situation was. A late hour in the morning blushed to find us in the arms of each other, as Mong Lewis or somebody else says. But the morning was pale when compared with the red on my cheek when I, the very next day, acquainted Fred Lamb with my adventure. Fred was absolutely dumb from astonishment and half choked with rage and pride. You told me he was, when he pleased, irresistible, said I. Yes, 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 muttered Fred Lamb between his closed teeth, but a woman who loves a man is blind to the perfections of every other. No matter, no matter. I am glad it has happened. I wish you joy. So she was like, okay, that's done. I immediately changed my lodgings for a furnished house at the west end of the town. She did not waste any time, that is for sure. Better calculated to receive my new lover whose passion knew no bounds. He often told me how much more beautiful I was than he had ever expected to find me. This all sounds great and, like, honestly happy for her, but she eventually says that that relationship didn't work out because Argyle already had someone else. He was involved with another woman, she says, for 19 years before she met him. So this was kind of like a heavy baggage that he was going into the relationship with. So she would, like, see his other woman in the opera wearing, like, a rose in her neckline, and then later he would come back home with that rose, like, on his suit or something. So she was like, you clearly have seen her. Like, this is not working. And she mentions a couple of times that she could only be involved with someone whose heart was, like, wholly hers, which is fair. So they did break up. He was really pissed off. Another person that she mentions that is like a historical figure that I think is really interesting to read about is Bob Brummel. The way she describes him is so completely different to what I would have imagined because we all know him as this like really fancy, elegant dandy, but he just sounds goofy. She is like talking to him. He's really direct. So she would like leave a party and he would be like, oh, are you going to see Argyle or are you going to see this guy? So he sounds like this gay friend. But then she also mentions that he was talking to her at a party. And then as soon as he saw food, he left her for cold chicken. Like literally, he left her to go and eat food. That was a party at her older sister, by the way. And it's just so funny to me because it's 100% something that would happen nowadays as well. Like you're talking to this guy who everyone likes and he's just a douchebag. But what I find interesting is not only that, but an anecdote that she tells shortly after from the same party where she low-key disses a man publicly for like no apparent reason. This is what went down. Brummel, in his zeal for cold chicken, soon appeared to forget everybody in the room. A loud, discordant laugh from the Honorable John Ward, who was addressing something to Luttrell at the other end of the table, led me to understand that he had just, in his own opinion, said a very good thing. Yet I saw his corner of the room full of serious faces. Don't you hate when your joke just does not land in the crowd? Like, I absolutely hate it. So then she's like coming after him. I'm not sure why, but she's just like, "Do you keep a valet, sir?" said I. "I believe I have a rascal of that kind at home," said the learned, ugly scion of nobility. She's so rude. With disgusting affectation. "Then," I retorted, "do in God's name bring him next Saturday to stand behind your chair. For what, I pray?" "Merely to laugh at your jokes," I rejoined. "It is such hard work for you, sir, who have both to cut the jokes and to laugh at them too." She is absolutely savage. When I was reading this, I was like, I cannot believe this was written in 1825 and it probably happened even years earlier. It's hilarious to think that this is a conversation that actually took place. And even if she remembered it wrong, this is 100% a conversation that could have taken place in that era. And I think this conversation, especially to me, it just shows how much more space women were allowed in these places than we tend to think. Like, we just assume that they went to the parties, they had to wait for someone to talk to them, they didn't have any opinions, they were not allowed to have any opinions, and even if they did have opinions, nobody listened to them. But this proves otherwise. She also mentions how she told Duke of Wellington that people want him hanged, and he's like, "Where did you read that?" And she's like, "I didn't read that. There is a lot of people that I talk to that have said that to me." So she had this very like street knowledge, street wisdom that was unattainable in other means, but just like you needed to mingle with people. And that's something that obviously a lot of women in the era did and were incredibly good at. And I think it's the skill, because it's not like written down anywhere, they didn't write any dissertations on it. We tend to believe that since women were not allowed to be as educated as men, that they were not street smart. And I personally think this proves that they absolutely were street smart and they were a lot more influential than we think, because I'm assuming if Duke of Wellington really did not know about that and he heard something like this, it could influence his decisions and whatever they may be. And if she did not say that, he could do something else. So it's subtle things like that that I think really made a difference in the social and political spectrum at the time that I think are completely just omitted from history. We do not study this. We do not remember this. And we just remember women for the more sensationalist stuff that they've done. For example, just like being someone's lover, but not the actual influence that they had, because it's difficult to measure and it's difficult to find any documents relating to it. So I understand, but it's pieces like this that remind me that all these women that were so closely involved with all those men, they must have had a massive influence on what was going on in the country at the time. So maybe they didn't formally rule the country, but they were incredibly involved in what was happening and probably in some decision making as well. I imagine if someone was in a relationship with a courtesan or just had a mistress, a lot of those men probably were actually in love with them. So they valued their opinions and what they had to say about things that were happening. So I do find it really interesting that there is this whole underground world of smart, independent, intelligent women that actually ruled those men, and history tends to completely ignore them. So the lesson to take from this is don't underestimate historical women, because if a daughter of a coal merchant could years later go to a party and tell an aristocrat, a respected gentleman, that he needs a valet to laugh at his jokes, then they could do anything. I think that's the takeaway from this text. Anyway, as I said, check out the memoirs of Harriet Wilson. There is a lot more juice involved in that text, so check it out. And as I've already mentioned, do check out my Patreon, which is available at patreon.com/textree. So do check that out if you want to support me and make sure there are more episodes coming. Thank you, and I'll hear you in another episode. Bye.